there's no doubt that phones were created to be addictive.
The psychology side of me knows that addiction triggers particular apparatus and parts of the brain that literally create a particular chemical reaction. It triggers similar things to alcohol and substance abuses. That's why porn is such a problem, because it triggers the same areas. And the phone addiction, we're already showing that it's really terrible for children to have
phones. It's a problem.
It's a real problem.
Welcome to today's episode of Falling to Freedom, where addiction ends and faith begins, the weekly podcast that brings thoughtful, informed, and challenging discussions about addiction to the forefront of everyone's minds. We join our host now, Chad Lacombe, for today's topic.
All right. Well, today we are joined by Dr. Potts, clinical psychologist, and we're going to be just exploring that intersection between addiction, substance abuse, and mental illness. I just can't help but observe that, you know, from when I was younger to today, the amount of mental illness that we see just out in the open. I mean, any observer, you know, going in any major town notices people on the street that are like talking to themselves, spinning around, waving their hands and doing stuff. And it's like, wow, it just seems like it is on the rise, at least a lot more visible. And it seems like there's a connection with substance abuse, with these things. And so we want to get your perspective. And I was hoping that maybe, Dr. Potts, you could just start by just kind of giving some background, right? Sure. So we have subject matter experts like you. And I think it's important for people to understand the schooling and the experience that you have. So if you wouldn't mind sharing.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind at all. So I was born and raised here in Southern California. Mm-hmm. And went to church my whole life, my family, my mom and dad, and three older sisters type of thing. And we would always go to church and that type of thing. Really good experience. And at one point, I'd gone to the Air Force Academy right out of high school. Mm. And I spent a little time there. But when I didn't graduate, but when I was done there, I ended up going to UCLA, Cal State Northridge, and then UCLA. Mm-hmm. And while I was at UCLA, did you remember, I don't know if you grew up in the area at all, but there was a Maranatha Nights at Knott's Berry Farm.
Okay.
And no, I don't so remember. They would have, you know, all these singers there, you know, the Brian Duncans. So going way back, old school type of thing. So, and Keith Green had done a concert there. Okay. And this was actually his memorial concert. Because he had just passed with a plane accident. Mm. And so they were doing a memorial concert there. And it was at that I felt a real call into ministry. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I did kind of switch gears, mm-hmm. and move towards ministry. And literally within that night was a Friday night, Saturday morning, I was telling my parents, hey, what had happened? They knew of Keith Green as well, because mm-hmm. we all went to a church where actually they went at the Vineyard.
Okay.
And so really interesting pieces within that. So at that point, I literally made a decision that weekend, hey, I'm going to go up to Northwest College and mm-hmm. study youth ministries. And the reason why I picked that school is because my youth pastor at the time had gone there. And so, you know, it's strange how God intervenes and brings the right people around.
Yeah.
And so that was my real introduction to ministry and becoming a youth pastor, and mm-hmm. studied there for a couple of years and got my bachelor's in youth ministries. While I was in youth ministries for about 14 years, I found myself consistently running into problems that I really felt way in over my head. Mm. In Tacoma, we had several different suicides that immediately I had to deal with. And that was really more than a little bit difficult, mm-hmm. To say the least. And you find yourself as a youth pastor in these predicaments that you're not really qualified to be doing therapy and counseling as a youth pastor. You're not completely ready, because I was only a few years older than a lot of the high schoolers, mm-hmm. And college students. And we had been growing like crazy, had something really great. We'd gone from like six or seven kids to running like 114, 120 on Wednesday nights. Mm-hmm. And it was just, you know, sometimes that just happens, right? And it was just a really, the Spirit of God just moving on our, mm-hmm. our church as well. And, but these things were, you know, like I said, way in over my head. So I started doing some thought and some research around the area of, well, what do I do? What kind of counseling classes can I get in? I'd had to take pastoral care and counseling classes at the school I was at. And you take, you know, a bunch of classes on addiction, recovery, God's perspective on those things. But there wasn't much that was real, that wasn't just book learning. Mm-hmm. And so that was a really interesting time frame because I found, like I said, I found myself in that. I moved down to, after Tacoma, I moved down to Lodi. And at that church was a real great place. Back in California, not far from here. Mm-hmm. And that way I could drive home in some ways. It was a little easier. But it was interesting because there was a lot more high school students with addiction. Mm-hmm. We had a boys' home.
What year was this?
This was probably in 1988.
Okay.
88, 89, 90. There was a lot more. In Tacoma, there was a lot more just starting with the Bloods and Crips. A lot more gangs, a lot more rivalry that way, and kind of making its inroads into the high school that was there. Mm-hmm. In Lodi, it was they're bored, so they were getting into trouble in mm-hmm. those ways, and did have one high schooler who prominent in the church family. The son had a problem with marijuana and alcohol, mm-hmm. and may have been cocaine if I'm remembering right, mm-hmm. but some different addiction issues that were going on. Again, just felt really in over my head. But then ended up trying to work with the family the best I could, but he went into recovery and they paid for a private, real expensive, even in that time, $25,000, $30,000 recovery program in 1988. Got out and found out immediately the mom, to celebrate getting out, got high with the son.
Oh my gosh.
So, you know, these are the types of things you just don't know
how to do. A little counterproductive.
Exactly. You don't know what to do because you're thinking you want to just tell the mom, seriously? Really? This is how we're going to celebrate? And you can quote scripture and you can do different things, but there's an interesting line between knowing what scripture is and then really actively having it participate in a faith that changes you, radically mm-hmm. changes you. And I think those were the bigger pieces that really found myself as I went into, and the youth groups got larger, the more I was needed to find a way to counsel and to mm-hmm. help families that were really hurting. They were really, really in pain. And it just didn't help to just throw scripture at them. Even though that's a part of it, it could get into like different like Stevens ministries or different counseling groups mm-hmm. that are in different types of churches. But you found yourself recognizing, boy, I really need to really upgrade my skills. Mm-hmm. After Lodi, I spent about 4.5 years at a church that was a lot larger as well. And again, I found myself working less with the students and more with the training of the leadership. But it didn't feel like I had the skills as mm. well. Leadership I could train in, but just what we were facing. We were facing kids coming out as questioning their identity, mm-hmm. gay, lesbian, mm-hmm. Running away from home, not feeling loved by their parents, addiction mm. issues, in with the wrong crowds, on mm-hmm. and on. And you're trying to reach them, and the church itself wants more game type things. Mm-hmm. I just couldn't get myself to want to do it.
Yeah.
So that's when I found myself leaving and going to Fuller Seminary, worked mm-hmm. on my MDiv there, really waiting on God to what was, you know, supposed to happen next. Mm-hmm. Just was an interesting process there. While I was there, I had a class with a professor who was a Presbyterian pastor, ordained minister, but also a psychologist. And he and I had lots of conversations. And he said, hey, do you know there's a program up in Seattle Pacific University that my friends have started? Would you be, you should look into it. It's built for persons like you with some experience. And that's literally what I did. Just within a couple of days of the conversation, had been praying, but really felt led, thinking this is a way for me to really move and stay in ministry, but also grow my skills in an area that I really wanted, which was helping people.
So you went to
Seattle Pacific University, moved up from Fuller Seminary here in Pasadena, and finished that degree and went up to Seattle. Started there in 97, summer 97, 98, and then, finished my degree there. And
so that's where you got your doctorate?
That's where I got my doctorate in clinical psychology.
Okay, yeah. So where did UCLA come into it then?
So UCLA was just kind of a, I thought, dream-wise, you know, this is where I want to be. And then when I went to that fall, when I'd kind of been disillusioned with the Air Force Academy, of course. The other piece is someone should have told me that, you know, there's going to be a lot more math than you were able to do. It was an engineering school, so here I was, and I was really out of my element. I was recruited to play basketball and volleyball. And so, you know, calculus was not my strong suit.
Gotcha.
So, and that's what you had to do. So,
You got your doctorate in clinical psychology.
Found myself working at a Seattle, as part of practicums and stuff, at a Seattle Community Center. Where there was, you know, one of my first clients there was a woman who was a drug addict, recovering drug addict. I was doing therapy with her, and she had AIDS, and she was in her early 40s, was not a very good prognosis, but had given her 8 or 9 year old daughter AIDS. And so just a real heavy, really deep, sad, grieving, moving through what had she had lost. And I found myself at different times working with clients and but wanting to pray with them and see if they would be open to that. And a lot of them were. They were more open to it than I anticipated. And so at that particular juncture, I found myself doing a lot of therapy with you know, clientele who were homeless, had been homeless, were in some kind of Section 8 housing, had the dual diagnosis of some kind of addiction, as well as mental health issues. And kind of almost who knows what came first, the chicken or the egg, because a lot of the drugs that people will use, like meth or cocaine, crack cocaine, different things like that, they affect and influence the brain chemistry in such a way that it really looks like schizophrenia, the hallucinations, the problems, the issues. And so even as I left Seattle with my degree and moved to Atascadero, you found these dual diagnoses, but it was really hard to tell what came first.
Yeah, and I think that that's kind of like when I started the conversation saying, I mean, all the people you see out on the street, and I mean, they're everywhere, and they're like talking to themselves and spinning around, and it's like a lot of those I feel from conversations I've had, it just feels like these are drug induced, you know, conditions that people are finding themselves in.
The person who finds themselves addicted to like a meth or a crack cocaine, it really becomes very difficult to really know first hand, is this schizophrenia from them genetically that now is just being triggered, or is it just this is a drug induced psychosis? But you treat it often as both. You have to, because like I said, it's a dual diagnosis, and they'll often at the Atascadero's and the Patton State Hospitals, they'll have.
Well, I'd like to, if you wouldn't mind, kind of going into, you know, your time at both of those state hospitals, Atascadero and Patton, because I'd like to kind of eventually bring it back to, you know, you. I think you're in a unique position. I don't know a ton of clinical psychologists, but I'm assuming that most of them are not also, you know, former pastors and believers. Yeah, so I really want to get your perspective on, you know, the role that faith plays in those things. But maybe you could just talk about your time at Atascadero and Patton. These are you know, state-run hospitals.
And so in that process, so you think of who we are and our sense of self and identity and self-worth and Those are huge parts of the way I see faith, right? Mm-hmm. And so here's this call to ministry that occurred, in the early 80s. That was like 1982, fall of 82. And prior to that, you know, God had been really working in me as well. Mm-hmm. And so you get to these places and you think, your colleagues in the church side of things see you as having left the ministry. Mm. And you take a hit. Because they, you know, no one wants to be now labeled, Dr. Potts, yeah, but he was Pastor Potts and he left the ministry.
Yeah.
And you realize that's not true. Still, I have a minister's heart, and as I'm working with these people, even at Patton State Hospital, you find yourself meeting persons who are recognizing, we see on your CV, your resume, that you were a youth pastor, and so we'd love to be able to use it in this way and that way and the other. And if you're open to it, God ends up using you. And so it took some time, to say the least, but it also, it was something that now I see myself every bit as still as fulfilling that original call to ministry, mm-hmm. even though I worked at Patton State Hospital. And the amount of patients, so at that hospital, it's all men, and they are, so they're either coming from or going to prison. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them...
Criminally insane,
yeah. And yet, if they get on the right medications and manage it and work in it, then they can be remarkably clear. It's just the problem often is when they go back out in the community, that's the core, is trying to get persons to get back out into the community. Mm-hmm. They will drop them off back into the element and environment that caused these particular things to occur. Mm. Families aren't supportive. I used to quote, and still do look at, a Harvard newsletter that's now quite a bit older, in 2008, 2009, that would show that when a person is released from one of these particular settings, only about 17 to 20% of all persons that were in these settings stay on the medications that allow them to be clear and focused. Their families don't believe, they often don't have the family support, so they don't believe that they have this mental illness, that they're actually hearing or seeing voices. They also think they should just suck it up and, you know, get over it. Culturally, often gets in the way as well of a person's recovery. And they don't get tied into, because they don't have the resources to get tied into a psychiatrist that helps them prescribe, and then also some kind of talk therapy that would help them move through and continue to move and grow. Mm-hmm. They don't even have themselves, you know, locked into a church. So you might have this person that at the hospital there is on this journey, this faith journey of trying to somehow see themselves as worth the forgiveness that God offers, which is a huge hurdle for them to get over, right? Mm. You know, how can I possibly be used of God? How can he possibly love me? All the things I've done, how any of this? And it really impacts their ability to move forward in faith. So they go back, and then families are offering them the ways to use. If they were tied in with gangs at all, then the gangs often will, you know, say, oh, hey, so-and-so is back. Let's get them running again. Mm. A lot of times they'll utilize the persons with the mental illness because they know they won't go down for as hard a time or will get put in a state hospital. Mm. And so they purposely pick on these persons who have often a lower IQ, you know, because education, when you're using drugs, a drug addiction starts often anywhere from 8 to 12 years old. Mm-hmm. Families introduce it. They don't mind it. Moms have ex-boyfriends that come into the house, and they trade them drugs for abusing their child, either sexually or even with drugs. And they would use the 8 to 12-year-olds, the gangs would, because they know that they're not going to get arrested or maybe go to a boys' home. So you got this addiction that starts real young, and they drop them off back in that environment. Mm-hmm. So it's a really struggle for me that way. But I'd find myself even there, we would run different types of groups. that would allow people to interact with who you are, faith, and we'd have to call it something different, but spirituality and your recovery, right? The road to recovery. And that would be a big piece. But you find yourself praying with a lot of the...
Well, I think if Jesus were, walking physically on the earth today, that seems from the Gospels, those would be the kind of places he would go.
Absolutely, right? And too, right? So he tries to remind us, that I live in you. I'm there with you.
Mm-hmm.
Where you go, that's where the kingdom of God is here, present. And I really believe that. And that's a big message of what we talk about. Mm-hmm. What I talk about is one, you need to be open to the idea as a psychologist and a believer that God can use you apart from just offering clinical ideas.
Yeah.
Because some of them work great. But I know, one, from personal experience, and two, from what I know faith-wise, there is zero lasting effect if it's done outside of our faith in Christ.
Yeah, well, that's why it's like, I think it's becoming more and more evident, because Scripture says we are spirit, soul, and body, that things that happen to us that have causes and effects in our life and solutions have to touch on those things, spirit, soul, and body.
Yeah.
And so it seems like that is, coming into the soulish part of it, right? The mind, the emotions, the will, those types of things. It doesn't mean that that is the only thing or even that it's the most important thing, but it is a part of the big picture, and that's kind of the way we feel about this whole addiction thing. That there are physiological effects that happen, and those have to be looked at. There are social and psychological effects of addiction, and maybe trauma wasn't the reason a person started using, but probably in that lifestyle there's going to be some trauma that happens. I mean, there's so many dynamics. It's not as simple as a lot of times people
think. And I think that's where it becomes a problem that the community doesn't want to look at. We don't want to see it. We want it on some other block, some other neighborhood, some other area, but we don't, we want to clean up our streets and get the homeless out of there. But it isn't that easy of a solution, right? We can offer them vouchers, but if they don't want to go live in a clean way, clean and sober way in that housing, which a lot of them don't.
Well, yeah, I mean, we had a whole episode on that, because your addiction is a huge part, substance abuse is a huge part of long-term homelessness.
Yeah,
so if you don't deal with that, you're not going to be addressing the
and
problem.
And for the person who really does struggle with schizophrenia or some kind of schizoaffective disorder, which would be the schizoaffective, so you have schizophrenia plus an affect, which is a mood disorder like anxiety, depression. The mixed is that it's both anxiety and depression, right? We used to call that bipolar disorder. Now we call it that. But that it's really interesting to think in terms of even a schizoaffective bipolar type, a mixed type anxiety and depression. It's got the voices all going on, plus you got this mood aspect, and they do need some sense of medication. So if they didn't get hooked up with a clinical psychiatrist who knows how to work with that and not just medicate them to the hilt and get them hooked on another aspect of things. And they often will take into account that if this person has had some addiction in the past, there's certain medications they can't and shouldn't be giving them because they're addictive at the core as well. But you have this person that if they have a family that doesn't believe or a culture that doesn't believe, that this is actually happening, it's just my brother's a jerk, then they're not going to help them get to the appointments they need to get to. And so what often happens is they'll get arrested by the police, and the police call it a mercy arrest to get them into, Twin Towers County Jail so that they can get medicated and spend 6, 8, 10 months at Patton State Hospital to get them cleaned up. But then it's this cycle, right? Get them cleaned up, get them on medication, because we'll see them, give them medications 3 times a day. They have 24/7 round the clock care, all kinds of things. That it's a much more stable environment, right? And then they get back to their housing, and this cycle repeats itself.
My personal opinion, I think they just have to be really careful with medication being the solution, right? It seems like, especially like I was listening to a conversation about, you know, the DSM-5 and like the recommendations and stuff in there aren't necessarily from scientific studies. They're from panel votes. And a lot of times those can be influenced from pharmaceutical companies and stuff. So drugs can a lot of times be just, you just need another drug. We need another drug. And sometimes I just think we have to, there's an appropriate place for that for sure. But like that can't be the solution to everything, another or a different medication, you know?
But so our faith would lead us to understanding that a part of our journey is to study, to look and to think about who we are and to recognize those verses, right, that say there isn't anything that can separate you from the love of God. Mm-hmm. There isn't anything that God is lacking in. Mm-hmm. There is nothing that you're going through that he can't solve.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very difficult to get that person to say, well, I wonder if I were to move towards this wellness and wholeness is found through Jesus and not through my psychiatrist. But there has to be a balance, right? So if you only give them medication, then when things get worse, the only option I have is to give you more medication. Every medication has side effects, period. And so if you self-medicate, I tell the guys even now, I tell them, when if you're self-medicating, you're telling me you're opposed to medication because of side effects, but you're medicating yourself. It's like it's a prescription. If I can just do this at night and do this in the morning and get myself moving, the only option I have when things are worse is to give myself more of that. And so until I realize that there has to be some interaction, some introduction of introspection, who I am.
The tough work.
The tough work, the hard work.
Drugs are the easy part.
Yeah, and so, yeah, that's exactly it. That's, and they want this easy fix because looking here tells me you've made some seriously terrible, crappy choices, and that doesn't feel good. And had I stayed on medication even a little bit and worked on this low self-esteem, that often the shame and the guilt that's there of who I am, what I've become, the things I've done in my life, instead of looking at those and saying, you know, those are all things that Christ died for and are put under the blood of the cross, really, and are redeemed, right? So that all that Christ sees, really, we stand before the Father spotless because of that work. So everything is under that. And that's hard to believe, right? So it's this battle for the mind, right? And so I often work in the area of, you know, what are you saying to yourself? What's your self-talk? What type of things are you saying that are causing you to move here because this is too uncomfortable?
Right.
Yeah, but you and I, even right to this day, and throughout our the whole of our life, we're going to need to work on things that God is calling to us, right? Here's what you need to work on.
Sanctification.
Growing, growing, learning, figuring out, recognizing that I still need Christ always, every day, always. And that, so as a psychologist, right, so I've said this before, as a psychologist, I can't see my psychology, who I am psychologically, without my theology. It's not a possibility. They're completely intertwined because who I am emotionally, God's created those emotions. And who I am psychologically, that's completely embedded in who I am theologically, which is where I have to ground myself, right?
So I'd like to kind of just hear a little bit about your time and experience at Tascadero and Patton. I did a little bit of research on Patton. It's got a long history. I didn't really do it on Tascadero, but I'm sure it's similar. Patton was first built in like 1890. And at that time, it appears they just lumped people, you know, anybody that was like substance abuse, epilepsy, psychosis. It didn't matter. You were basically insane is the word that they would use. And these were considered insane asylums, right? It's like you would never be able to use those words today, right? That's just not correct terminology. But it just seemed like they just lumped everybody together. And then they were doing like electroshock therapy and later lobotomies, all this crazy stuff. So, and I think people that know anything about the history of those places probably still have those kind of thoughts in their mind. So what would like day to day in Patton or Tascadero, what would that look like?
You know, it wouldn't look a whole lot different in some ways than some persons that are in some kind of structured treatment or care, to be honest. The exception is, you know, so Patton is a, and so is a Tascadero. They're both maximum security. So you have all kinds of guards and they do have, you know, routines and schedules.
This
and,
would be the place if somebody's in court for, let's say, murder. And it's determined that they were insane when they did it. This is where they would go. Rather than a state.
So you'd have certain parts of the hospital that are set up that the last place I worked at Patton State Hospital was what they call incompetent to stand trial. And so those are the ones that are now they've come over because they're trying to figure out the and going through the legal process of becoming not medically, mentally able to stand trial at all. And so they, some people want that because they think, well, this is a quicker path to getting out if I can somehow be found completely incompetent, mentally not competent. And they become like a ward of the state. And they have the legal numbers that go around these particular terminology as well. But they, so that's one side of the hospital. Another side, they have like an east side and a west side and a central compound. The west side is persons who have then become, and they are actually more living there as a person who is mentally not able to be out in society. So they become the wards of the state, literally. And so the interesting piece is I have met, you know, murderers, persons who have, because of the whatever drug-induced psychosis, whatever drugs they were on, whatever combination of their mental illness as well, have murdered somebody. And so we've seen everything, right? Murdered fathers, murdered mothers, murdered families. I had one person who was a mom who was so depressed and suicidal, killed her children and a failed attempt of suicide on herself. And we've had everything you can possibly think of, right? Persons who are were part of the Mexican mafia and they're as a part of different things and were big drug dealers and cartel even on our units and different things. And so it's very interesting to see these different levels. So
how much do you see like substance abuse and addiction being a part of these people's lives prior to coming into your care there?
I almost want to say 100% because at that hospital, it would be very rare, more rare to come as a schizophrenic, untreated schizophrenic out in the community committing a crime. Although I did meet a woman who had been in the hospital for a long time. Her crime was that she shot, attempted murder, shot somebody who she thought had stolen her daughter, who lived across the country. And so in the church, she literally shot the woman and attempted to kill her. The woman lived, but the crime itself was attempted murder, and she had an 11-year sentence, but she had been in the hospital 20-plus years, and there was no no possibility she was going to get out. Mm. Even though medication-wise, now she was living a healthier life. But she was addicted to crack cocaine and things like that in the community as well. So it's very rare to see that.
I just think it's an important point. You know, it's like if you were able to snap your finger and all substance abuse and addiction disappeared, it sounds like Patton would be out of business. And a lot of these places. Yeah. And the reason I say that is because if you truly want to address these things, like mental illness is a big thing right now. I mean, everywhere you look, there's not only an awareness of it because it's all around us and we see it. There's also, at least, you know, in words, a desire to try and deal with it and recognizing it as a problem and trying to find solutions. But it doesn't seem like you're going to be able to fully address it if you don't also address substance abuse.
Yeah.
Because it seems like it's a precursor to it.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, really hit the nail on the head. So when you think about mental illness and in the community and you see the person who is, you know, actively psychotic sitting on a corner or sitting somewhere and they're pushing their cart, their shopping cart full of stuff, that person with the shopping cart is really unwell, because that's not even a person that's willing to go into any kind of housing. Mm-hmm. When I worked up in Seattle, these people knew where all of the homeless shelters were, where the free meals were. They knew how to get there. Mm-hmm. And they actually in Seattle had a bus system that would allow persons within the city, they could take it for free and get around to these different, you know, agencies and different churches that had beds and meals and things like that. Whereas with Patton, it just is very hard when the goal of incompetent to stand trial is just to get them competent to stand trial, not ready for the community.
Right.
So we're not doing therapy with them. Mm. The very thing they desperately need is groups to make them healthier in the community. What we do offer is groups to make them healthier and ready to stand trial, because what often happens is you get them ready to go back to Twin Towers to face their crime, and then that facility has a different way of medicating. Now that's interrupted and they may decompensate and have to come back.
Doesn't sound like it's a big incentive for that person to get well.
No.
We want you to get well so you can go be punished.
And go well, and that end. They'll try to serve out their time at Patton. Mm-hmm. And so they'll either cheek meds, and meaning they're not taking them, or do different things that allow them to not go back to a county holding or into a place that's ready, like, to be able to, you know, stand trial. And so the system completely works against themselves. And so there isn't this massive behavioral emphasis on recovery. It's a medical model. Even though you look at Patton State Hospital, and my pet peeve has always been, it's a behavioral institution. They're there for behavioral reasons, but we're using the medical model to treat them. So what that means is medicine first, which I don't completely disagree. We need to stabilize them so we can do treatment with them. That's what we have to get to. We have to get to that. And if we don't get to that, ultimately, again, the only option we have is more meds or the newer med. You know, for a long while, we had Invega Sustenna at the cost of, to the county, of $1,500 a shot. Well, they go in the community, they're not going to give them that at the hospital, because we have, in some ways, I don't know if that's accurate or not, because I was never privy to these conversations, right? But it seemed as though they understood that we'll do this at the state level and in these hospitals and give them this particular medication. Now they have the long-lasting 30-day supplies and different things. But it doesn't, it never addresses the heart of the matter, which is... how do we help these persons that the environment itself that they go into is a huge part and plays a giant role in this person's addiction. And so recovery somehow, some way, needs to address that environment. So this person pushing the cart isn't completely floridly psychotic and out of his mind that he sees getting into treatment and housing as a bad thing, mm-hmm. right? I can't tell you how many persons who see themselves saw themselves as Jesus or saw themselves as Satan or saw themselves as the owning France or the president. We at one point had two different people who were owning France and owning different parts, and they would argue with each other before they could get medicated. Who had ownership? And the stories would just be unbelievable about how, mm-hmm. I took a rowboat from this particular place and I landed here and I'm from France. I own this country, own that country, and have multiple degrees. But the odd thing is, so we never saw them as the psychosis saying, these really small, menial things. I have a job at Burger King. I've worked myself up to a manager. And, I have...
Always grandiose.
It's this huge, giant, right? So what that speaks to is the self-esteem, the self-worth. Mm. You think you're a doctor. Well, I have 7 doctorates in this area from... And they could list the universities that they say they have it. And I really think that's at the heart of this, that Satan attacks who you are... And worthwise, your value is only in these particular things, where in Christ he says, those things aren't valuable either. What's valuable is knowing me, and that if you think you need something, I own the cattle on the 10,000 hills. Mm-hmm. All the fish that swim and all the animals that crawl the earth, they're mine. Everything on this earth is mine to... manage, and it could be to assist you if you allow it, but what comes first is your relationship with me, and you'll recognize as you grow in me that those are remarkably meaningless for me to offer to you. And your self-worth, we want to find the only value. Once you were not a king, you were nothing, you weren't a child. But in me, now you're a child of the Most High, the King of Kings. And that's what's really interesting, is that's the battle, is to find this worth, right? And so we get caught up into these gangs that offer me sense of self and sense of self-worth and meaning, right? Even though they're robbing us and stealing from us. So we see these persons in these hospitals, the gang affiliations. When I moved from Atascadero to Patton, my first unit, because nobody wanted to work on them, was an all-female unit. Mm-hmm. So many of the females on that unit had some kind of faith and belief in Christ. Mm. But it's just so damaged, because I found, and there's tons of articles that talk about the females that go from the prison population to a state hospital, about 75 to 90% have been abused and have some kind of PTSD. So you've got complicating the schizophrenia, the drug abuse is this PTSD of trauma. Mm-hmm. If they were in a gang, they were multiple rapes. Mm-hmm. If they were with a parents that had addiction, the mom selling them off to boyfriends and multiple boyfriends over time happened and occurred all the way till they were 8, 10, 12, 13 years old. Mm. And then at that stage, the gangs would come in and take them over. If they were in a gang, which a lot of them, about 40 to 60% had some sort of gang affiliation, which means they didn't, the women didn't rise to the top of leadership in gangs. Mm-hmm. They were completely abused. So as a way to manage these horrible feelings and trauma that they went through, self-medicating and drugs were the place to go.
Yeah.
But behaviorally, I know, because that's all I do now is work with persons in trauma. And this trauma, we start seeing it now more and more, because I love the idea that we're here talking about this, because there is no... person that doesn't understand to a degree or another what heightened anxiety does. Mm-hmm. What heightened, and the real low, when I say heightened, really depths of depression does. Mm-hmm. You can't go through puberty, junior high, as a female, and not feel some sense of self-esteem and self-consciousness, because there's all this pressure to have to, you know, meet those peer standards, right? Mm. And in high school, you know, people make their choices, right? And align themselves with the groups that say, listen, you're okay. And the church has to find a way to reach those youth. And so it's funny to be at this end of a youth pastor and find myself here working with, you know, now these veterans, two-star generals, rear admirals, majors, colonels, have a lieutenant colonel a couple of weeks ago breaking down in tears because he just can't manage how he's feeling because of the trauma he's seen and gone mm-hmm. through. And that's, it's insane what it is we do as humans to others.
Mm-hmm.
And so they end up in these Patton State hospitals. If we were to take away and snap our fingers addiction, they wouldn't be empty, but we'd be in a healthier place to say, we're not going to use medication. We're going to say, what we need you to do is actively really look inwardly and begin to explore the areas of your mistrust of others, ways of managing your schizophrenia that isn't tainted by a cultural influence that says, in our culture, we don't use any kind of medication. We don't believe in schizophrenia. We think you're making it all up, right? And a lot of the guys will say, if I go back to prison, there's no way. I was in this particular gang. They won't let me take medications. My gang members there at Chino Men's Prison or at the Chino Women's Institution. I've gone up to Soledad, other prisons where I've done evaluations and different things at, and I go out to, you know, several different prisons actually even now do evaluations. And they can't take medications without really risking getting beat up really badly by the gang members there that say that you can't. You're not allowed to.
Mm.
So there's just these stigma that faces these things. So it's easier to self-medicate. People can, the community can say, I'm better with it that way than saying, you know, a part of our environment pushes people into these places, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's beautiful to see on one hand, persons like Michael Phelps talk about depression, mm-hmm. others who stand up for themselves and say, you know, I'm really struggling and battling with these things. And they're doing therapy. The sad part is that it does occur, mm-hmm. you know. But I like that it's willing to be brought up. I think in churches, I love that for myself at Water of Life, Pastor Dan was willing to bring up different times and frames and say, listen, you know, we do therapy. I've done therapy. My wife and I, our family, we've done family therapy. Because you have to role model the idea that we're not perfect. We are broken. Mm-hmm. And talking things and working things out is how God has designed us, right? Right, to talk with each other, to have persons that we would really open ourselves up with, like, and we have examples of that, I think, throughout scripture.
For sure.
Yeah.
So I'd like to just finish up with one question that it's kind of adjacent to this conversation, sure. but I just thought about it when you were talking, especially with young people. What role do you think, like, phones and technology plays into, you know, the levels of depression and low self-esteem and just the need to, like, the pressure that comes on a person to fit a thing, or just even just like staring at these things? And I mean, there's no doubt that phones were created to be addictive, right? I mean, it's like they just make you want to stay on that thing and scroll and just suck up time and everything. Yeah. So any thoughts on that? I just thought about it when you were kind of mentioning young people.
Exactly right. So, you know, we talk about addiction. And so in think in terms of the psychology side of me knows that addiction triggers particular apparatus and parts of the brain that literally create a particular chemical reaction.
Mm-hmm. Talking like endorphins.
Endorphins and serotonin and different things as well. Cravings. That's why it becomes so difficult, because these particular parts of the brain, when addiction hits, it literally that part of the brain will then trigger a chemical reaction until it's calmed, until that craving's met. Now we have medications that can calm those cravings, and those cravings then are reduced because we're able to introduce a medication to solve that to an extent or another. What we want to say is those addictions, we can calm the craving, but that's your chance then to work on the behavioral aspect. When I say the behavioral aspect is the conversation piece. Mm-hmm. So when we're looking at phones, it triggers similar things to the alcohol and substance abuses. Mm-hmm. That's why gambling is such a problem. Because it triggers the same area. That's why porn is such a problem, because it triggers the same areas. Two areas we don't want to know about, right? And very rarely, even more in the shadows of persons' lives. Mm-hmm. And the phone addiction, I think we're going to see lots of research and studies that show, we're already showing that it's really terrible for children to have
phones. It's a problem.
It's a real problem. So, you know, the way you would want is to find a way to, you know, just even measure, well, are you able to take a weekend break from your phone?
Not many people. I've heard stories of parents, like, they're going on a weekend vacation, they're like, no phones, and the kids are just going ballistic. Right. And I'm just like...
But that's where, so I would, if it was working with someone who's an alcoholic, and even now, like this week, I'm sure I'll have two or three people, I'll talk with them, say, have you ever tried to not drink for, let's say, a week, or this weekend? You know that it's the weekend, you deserve that drink because you worked hard all weekend, all week. Can you just not? Or if you say you do blackout, you drink to black out because I want to forget. And a lot of them do that. A lot of these military, this is their answer. And that's brought up in a culture that says, military-wise, what do you mean you aren't going to drink? This is what we do. Mm-hmm. The Marines and Army, absolutely. Mm. You almost not. Don't get me started on that military aspect of thing. But you want to say, can you put it down for a weekend? And they say, well, I've tried that, and yeah, I think I can do that. Well, then do that. Don't just think you can do it. Do it. See where you're at. Find out. And then if you're not willing to, not able to put it down, are you willing to go seek treatment? And that's where I would challenge the teenager, and the parents and the family, say, there's so much help available. That is, why not look up, you know, ways of getting treatment? Go into your counselors at high school and say, listen, I want to find a way to put my phone down.
Well, those of us that have lived in both worlds, pre-phones and now, it's just obvious they're missing something in life. Yeah. I mean, where's being out on your bicycle, just exploring town, and right. I mean, doing things that kids, what we would consider normal kids would do. It's like, that is just like missing.
Right, and going into the library to look at an encyclopedia or find books and read the book and look at it and read chapters.
Yeah.
And it is, in that sense, you know, it is a brave new world, but the addictions that come with it are things that we didn't anticipate.
Sure.
And, you know, I think that's really, it is going to be at the forefront. You know, it's a frontier exploration of, Yeah.
Well, I hope you're a part of that.
I hope so too. I love what I'm doing right now. I really do. But I also know that now, as a psychologist, I see, okay, God, as I'm working with these veterans, make me open this week to those who are bringing up that piece of the philosophical piece, that soul that says this is right, the biological, psychological, social aspects of who we are as humans, the spiritual side of who we are, there's a fourth piece. And that fourth piece, when it's off, it is the phone getting in the way of my life? Would it be okay if I picked up the book and read a chapter today in my book, and not just an iPad?
Yeah, or not the Kindle.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, if you're open to it, I'd like to maybe at some point in the future have you back and maybe just kind of delve in. I know you're very passionate about the work you're doing now with veterans and PTSD, and that's definitely an area that we'd like to go into and talk about that as well, and the substance abuse that happens because of that. We've done some with first responders for sure. So, maybe if you're open in the future and we can talk about that. But I'm so glad that there are people like you that, you know, are able to enter into this field with the credentials and the knowledge of the psychological aspects of things, but with a biblical foundation. Yeah. I think that's just missing so many times in people's perspective. You know, when you go in lacking that, you're just missing some of the stuff to help put the whole picture together. Yeah. And I love the fact that you are able to bring those things together.
Unique. Yeah, I'd love that, because the one dynamic that stays true to all of that is family. And it's such an incredible, interesting piece, right? So the kid will put down the phone if the parent sets the rules.
Yeah.
To an extent, right?
Yeah.
And it's really interesting how God is trying to get at our hearts. And so I'd love that, to be able to come back. And then it's such a thumbnail sketch today, but we could, over time, certainly, I'd love to come back periodic and just bring up these things and continue the conversation, because I would suspect for yourself, it just starts these questions and the wheel spinning of, hey, I wish we had touched on this area more and hit more. And, it'd be great.
And we're learning. I mean, it's like a part of doing this podcast is educating ourselves as well, you know, because even with our own experiences in this world, it's very narrow, you know. We just love being able to be open-minded, listen to people, and just hear how these things are connected.
Yeah, I'd love that. That'd be great. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Potts, for coming, making the trip out here and doing this podcast. I know it's going to be great, and we look forward to talking to you again in the future.
That'd be great. Thanks so much. Thanks a lot. I really appreciate it, too. Thanks, man.
Thank you for being a part of this much-needed conversation as we expose the raw truths about addiction. Don't forget to like, follow, and most importantly, share. Remember, addiction is the dirty little secret that every family deals with, but nobody wants to talk about.